You know, this is episode 190.
Is it really? We're going to do something special for episode 200.
Yeah, but I really want to do 2 at the end of the year.
2 at the end of the year.
That echo?
No.
Yeah, I know that doesn't work out.
Is this episode 190 of the live Q&A, or is this episode 190 of the podcast?
I think it's 190 of the podcasts.
Okay.
Yeah.
And basically what you're saying is you want to do another 9 episodes, 10 episodes, between now and the 22nd of December.
Yeah.
You can get fucked, mate. I'm busy here, son. Jesus Christ almighty. Right, first question. Who's going? Let me ask you for the first one for a change. It doesn't happen very often. I'm starting to wonder whether I'm too loose with tracking my clients' nutrition. I really struggle with ways to actually measure and manage their intake. If we're taking a more habit-based approach and not counting calories. That's the end of the question.
Okay. First thing is initial assessment, I think, of what's aligned with their goal, first of all, obviously. And I think it's matching a method to the person at the end of the day. Like, we could reel off the standard one, which is like MyFitnessPal and keeping a food diary. But there's also things like making them aware of like what they're actually doing in the day. And that could just be based on habits to begin with. Like, to change any habits, you first got to be aware of what you're doing currently. So whether that's a compliance rating in regards to them establishing that individually. But I also think preceding that, it's going to be breaking down their beliefs and their values behind nutrition. Like, what do they believe is resulting them in getting X result, or what's got them to this point now? And I think using that as a baseline to then establish those things, because what we could do is straight off the bat, we could go, right, we need to track. Well, if they've got any type of fear of judgment, from giving you that information, or there's preconceived notions about good and bad, then the likelihood is that tracking is going to be inaccurate. And we've got to put, I think we've got to assume that it's going to be to some degree. So in my opinion, before we track, we've got to establish their viewpoints, their beliefs, their values behind it, and build the relationship to a certain point where tracking is going to be useful because of the accuracy and the understanding behind it. That's where I would start with it all, to be honest. Because we could sit here and reel off a load of different ways of tracking, but ultimately it's how you set that up for that person, in my opinion. That's where I'd start with people. And I think the question I would ask you if you were sitting here is, what makes you believe you're being too loose with tracking, and why do you think you need to be more tighter with tracking with clients? Anything you'd add?
No, I want to ask questions, and that's a very shit for a Q&A.
Yeah.
So I don't think I'll add anything, because it's difficult to say, because we're talking about an individual, aren't we, in regards to your clients. So to your ending point there, I think that's really important to find what evidence you have that you are being too loose with your client's nutrition. And then how you would coach that moving forward with them clients that potentially are struggling to achieve results. And that's probably where you're pinpointing that issue. But don't want it to sound shite. But yeah, like, I would be asking myself, what evidence have I got? To challenge your own thoughts on it. Okay. Because a lot of the time it might be one or two clients aren't getting results. They've got that type of method compared to clients who are, I don't know, tracking on MyFitnessPal, and they're doing all right. they're not progressing the same. Well, if that's the case, then it's about going back to kind of investigating or some level of intervention if the client is ready to have a chat. And that means going back to a coaching-based conversation that leads to reflective questions to get the client to come up with maybe some solutions to this problem. But yeah, it's to kind of put this out on a podcast and then deliver it. It very much depends on that person and the evidence that you've got. Anyway, go on, next question.
How to not get overwhelmed with work when you struggle to get times and schedules?
Okay, so how to not get overwhelmed? Let me tackle that first, right? For me, it's great feedback. It's good feedback that is more than likely telling you that as much as you probably don't want to hear this, you are underprepared. And I'll give you an example of this, right? I have definitely landed into Monday today overwhelmed. But I'm also accepting the fact that usually I will work for 4 hours on a Sunday doing certain things that I've had to do in replacement of my session this morning. Now, are we ever going to have a weekend like that? It happens once a year where we throw an event and all of that type of stuff. So something's got to give. So then you've got to challenge yourself on your expectations of that. It's kind of going, accepting things are going to fuck up for a short period of time. How to get back on track with that and how to be more prepared is to make sure that you've got timing that minimizes that level of overwhelm, which means is probably getting everything out of the way and then sitting there with the things that you feel like you absolutely need to do on a weekly basis or on a daily basis, or even these ad hoc tasks that might come up, right? And go, right, let me have an hour where I'm just sorting my shit out. And then when I sort my shit out, I'm then going to look at, and I know you've put here that you struggle with times and schedules, but again, I'm probably going to be direct and a bit of an ass. You have to, as a business owner, find a way to put processes into your week that helps you operate, which means that you're going to have to find some type of schedule or time to help minimize the overwhelm. And whether that is that you sit there on a set time of the week and you plan your tasks out and you put that into your schedule and you make them reoccurring, and you prioritize your time and your schedule in that way, whether you do that on a Google calendar, an Outlook calendar, whether you use TickTick, whether you use Microsoft to do, whatever, your business has to have processes and systems to help it operate and run. If it doesn't, you will always be underprepared, i.e. have a level of overwhelm. So for me, it just is a great sign, and it depends how you've seen it. The growth mindset in me is going, this is a fucking good sign that you've been underprepared. Learn from it. What could you do next time? A bit like me this weekend, from this weekend. What could I have learned from it? Maybe I could have set myself up better on Thursday to make sure I don't land on Monday where I have to sacrifice my session. But there was parts of my Sunday that I didn't expect to happen. For example, family stuff and all of that. So this is always going to crop up. And hopefully if you kind of see it as a bit of a growth mindset and go, right, what can I learn from that? Right, learn this, this, and this. What do I need to sacrifice now and take on the chin? Like me this morning, I've got rid of my session to spend an hour and a half just focused on now, setting my tasks up and my week up. So I don't want to give it the big I am of this is what I do and this is what you should do. I'm not saying that, but it's more so great feedback that we're being underprepared, and you have to have processes and systems to make you prepared so you're not overwhelmed. Will it still come? Yes, but at least you can minimize it. Anything you'd add?
No.
Tell us at least one thing you learned from the other speakers at the conference this weekend.
Honestly, nothing right now springs to mind, but I'm not saying I didn't learn anything. I'm saying I've got to process it and have a bit of a have a bit of time to watch things back, purely because a lot of things were going on for us. But there were some amazing, amazing things. I did, but there are very, very specific things, very specific things. But for me, I need to go back and I need to watch it. I need to digest it. I need to put things down just purely because we were just here, there and everywhere. And to a bit of Ant's point then, to be honest, from yesterday morning and also holding myself back from doing work at the conference as well, I've just got to get these few days of getting my head back in and prioritizing things for me to then let that download a little bit. But there's lots of takeaways from the actual conference itself, as well as the speakers. So yeah, that's my, I don't want to throw something out there for the sake of something, throwing something out there. What would you say? Anything springs up?
Yeah, there is quite a few points that spring up. I think one new thing I learned that's relevant to, say, social media, and it sticks out in my head because I like little sayings, don't I? Is when Simon said, don't post and ghost. So basically, like, if you want to play about with the algorithm, which much of you do, I'm not sure I'll be doing this, but if you want to give the algorithm what you want, one thing not to do is post on social media and then just fucking disappear. Basically, what he said was stay around for about an hour after, whether that's creating conversations, being in people's DMs for whatever reason, or talking on your stories and so on for that hour after. So that helps with the algorithm, apparently. I never knew that before that day. Will I use it? Maybe in the future. Definitely not this week, because I'm trying to pick up my head. But yeah, maybe in the future. So I thought that might be relevant. There was plenty of takeaways in every talk, but I think it's stuff that personally I already knew, but it's not something that probably the room knew. So I think there was so much stuff that the guys landed that I thought was brilliant. But I'm a bit, well, not strange in that way. I am strange, but I remember certain things like don't post and ghost and then relate to a point. So that kind of helps me kind of remember things. And I thought Simon delivered that really well. Yeah, so that's the one thing that sticks out in my head. Next one.
How do you keep ticking the boxes and getting the important stuff done when life happens?
Oh, fucking hell. How relevant is that? Okay, let me think about that to answer it. I think if you can plan for 80% of your week, month, from a business operations perspective, to go as clear as possible and as planned as possible, then it should allow for 20% of life to be thrown at you. Okay. And I know that's really easy said than done. But personally, I think this is where being self-employed, we can actually become quite, and it's a benefit, but it's also a bit of a curse. We can actually become quite relaxed on our boundaries in regards to on ourselves of when we expect to work and don't. And it is a great benefit of being self-employed, but it is a bit of a fucker as well, which meaning if you said you're going to do certain things in certain days and times and you've put that in and it's a process, in theory, you should work it, right? You should operate like you've been employed by someone. That's the kind of mindset I try to have sometimes, that actually if you were employed and someone else was managing you and you had tasks and processes and deadlines, well, you wouldn't be able to wriggle out of this, so fucking get it done. Even if life does get in the way sometimes. But obviously, there's going to be some flexibility in that. So I think, okay, let me put this into practical tips because I'm just waffling bullshit. My first point would be is try and stay, similar to what I said before, as scheduled and as process-driven as possible with your working week, where you have reoccurring processes, reoccurring systems, reoccurring tasks. And I would say for about 80% of your week, you want to try and stay strict on that, okay? When life gets in the way, there's some certain things that you just can't help, right? And I think it's putting a level of acceptance on that and knowing, I'll use my own example, knowing that this might be an element of sacrifice for that within your working week next week, for example. But for me, the best way to manage that is to be, I'm dead boring with this because I've said it twice on this one and I say it on every fucking live Q&A, is to be as process driven as possible, not giving yourself big blocks of work, of gaps within your schedule where you've got this paradox of choice where you can do whatever you want. And then when life does get in the way, you can prioritize life over business. I think there has to be a manageable boundary on that. But it clearly depends what it is. Yeah, I've waffled a bit there. Go on, add some context to that, Nick, or you put your points to it.
I'd agree. I spoke a lot about on Saturday morning about like having working so you can have freedom. And I think being self-employed, a lot of the time you'll come into that because, you know, well, first of all, our industry is very much pro, the model screams self-employment, doesn't it? Unless you're a manager of a gym or whatnot. And even if that's an independent gym, you're still self-employed. So it does scream that. Where the problems come around is that what we are generally is way too loose and free with our time early on, which creates really shitty habits when time becomes then a premium, i.e. you get busier, and then the processes that you haven't created need to be set, but you haven't got those habits in place. So when we start to kind of promote massively, is almost literally micromanaging yourself from day one. People look at that and go, well, that's why? Because I've got all this time and I haven't got that. I'll do it when I've got clients. Or you're too, a lot of the time, it's way harder at that point because your attention is on clients, 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 but then you haven't got those processes and habits in place. So it's really hard to get that ingrained. So it's about micromanaging yourself to the point where then you don't have to because habits are there. And that's really difficult because it's usually the stuff you don't like to do. It's usually the stuff that you find really hard, which makes it even harder to then stick to the times because you don't enjoy it and you find it really difficult. So you procrastinate. So it, in my opinion, it's creating that earlier on or as early as possible. Like we were very fortunate because we had, let's say, I would call it extreme accountability to a certain degree, because with the full-time jobs we were doing, we were kind of doing what we were doing now, but we had external accountability from a company. Do you know what I mean? But that was very, and we also had like a bit of a trial run at this during the pandemic where we were working from home and we were basically left to it because no one was in the office except for us and our immediate manager. So we kind of did that, which really set us up for now. Like I'll start at 8 o'clock in the morning. It'll be, it's ingrained. Like there's no question about it. Absolutely. And I won't finish work early. There's no question about it. And I think that's because of the extreme accountability we had and also the micromanaging of what we've done. And it's not perfect at all, but I think that's a huge thing that a lot of self-employed coaches and personal trainers and gym owners need. And I think when then that happens, it makes it a lot easier for you to then prioritize the stuff that you need to get done and also understand, to one of Emma's points on Saturday, and it's something, to be honest, is in our training, which I always forget there, to be honest with you, is that 80-20 principle.
Just going to bring this up.
That Pareto.
Yeah, the reason why I was, go on.
Yeah, that Pareto's theory of knowing, like, right, well, I'd like and enjoy to do this onboarding stuff over here, but that's probably not a part of the prioritized tasks that are going to get you 80% of the results of your business right now. Because the 20% is usually the stuff that you find really, really hard.
Yeah. What I was going to add is, relating back to my point before, I'm more than confident that the percentage of work that I do every week on a Sunday evening sets us up from a marketing sense for 80% of the results that we get, because it creates me time back throughout the week. And what it does is set me up. And I've had that there, and Nick can back me on this, because I used to say 8 years ago of delivering workshops, I've had that there since probably 2011. I've not wanted to do it, but as a coach, it really started to help me. I started to see that actually them 4 hours I do on a Sunday night really set the frame for the rest of the week. And I confidently saying that that brings me the level of results I'll bring into any business, whether it was me as a coach, me as a gym, me as a mentor now. So it's easy for me to relate to that. And the reason why I'm bringing this up is because last night, because we had the event, I had my mum stay at my house, have the kids, and then my mum had arranged this full family meal and loads of people come and all of this. And I didn't really know that that was happening, but that was encroaching in that time massively. But what's hard is one of my biggest values is family. I'm like, this never happens. I'm talking everyone from my family there for 3-4 hours together. Probably happens once a year maximum. And I'm like, fuck, I've got work to do here. Do you know what I mean? I even had a call that I'd put moved from Friday. So there was an element where I sat there and I was like, I have to, regardless of this, I have to work. So for me, I think no matter how far you get within the industry, how experienced, how successful you are and all of that, for me, when you are self-employed, you have to create consequence. You have to create processes and consequence. So for me, last night, I stayed there and ate into an hour of my work time. But I left early and come home to work. But with that, didn't sit well with me. And my consequence was I sacrificed that hour this morning to train that I do every week, that I do every day. And that was shit. But fact is, it comes part and parcel. And personally, I feel one of the biggest problems most PTs have is you're not willing to create that sacrifice and consequence and that work-related environment sometimes when you're not in business, when you've not got that appointment. And I think for me personally, if you did do that, it'd minimize overwhelm, you'd operate better, you'd get 20% of the work, we'll reap the 80% of the rewards of all of the stuff that we've said. And when life does happen, you probably still can be present and take part in it, because you're operating really well. But also, even if that encroaches it like last night, you can easily just pull a little consequence and sacrifice into it that is just part and parcel. So I know we've gone on about this, but I actually think it's mega important and the foundation of most people's business. So yeah, they're just the added points that I wanted to make. And the reason why I've gone on about my situation is because it really relates to them two questions. But yeah, next one. How many touch points would you like to have with a prospect on the gym floor before you suggest a taster?
Okay, two parts of this question. The first one is, statistically, there's research out there that says you increase the likelihood of someone buying a service, a product, a service, when it gets to between 5 to 8, let's call it, contacts or interactions, up to 80% versus having one interaction with someone. So first of all, the understanding and context underneath that is the fact that people are buying a personal service. What needs to be present for that? It's that know, like, and trust and value behind it. So it's not, doesn't take you a rocket science to go, if I have more contact and interactions with people, unless I'm an absolute knob and I don't listen, I'm going to do that generally. So that's the first thing. But then there's also, you've got to read the situation and you've got to read the person, right? So I'm not saying that you wait until five interactions and then you ask for a taster session. What I'm saying is listen to what's happening with that person in the conversation in the moment, because that might happen way quicker. That might happen way slower down the line. But the key thing here is you've got to take each individual as it comes. So I think if you're in that situation, I would be focusing a lot more on what the person is saying to me, how they're saying it, and if a taster session, a consultation, a program, an induction, whatever it is that's going to help that person based on their responses to my questions, that's the right time. So I know that's not a how many. Well, I have given you how many, but it very much depends on, like, for example, you'll meet people just in life in general who you will connect to immediately, that you'll get, you have common ground, you can communicate really freely. There's no barriers. You'll meet people, other people that you'll just find really hard to get along with. You'll find really hard to communicate with. And so that will take longer. So I think you've got to read the situation. Obviously, I wouldn't promote you go out there and go up to people and be a closed question of, do you want a taste session, yes or no? You'll get some yeses, you'll get some nos. You'll get way more nos than you will yeses. The yeses won't have no, like, and trust present. So you could probably expect, if they do come in for a taster, or there's going to be a lower turnout rate. Secondly, that if they do sign up for your service, they probably won't value it as much or trust you as much versus you speaking to them 2, 3, 4, 5 times on the gym floor and helping them. So that they'll probably buy into the lowest cost package, lowest commitment package. Therefore, usually not get the greatest results in the world and not be great and probably have a higher churn rate through the business, usually. So it's about asking the great questions in regard and about being inquisitive and curious about where they are, what's happened in the past, where they're at currently, where do they want to go, where are the gaps missing, and how you can help them. So hope that's given you two sides of of an answer to that question, which is a really good question. Anything to add?
No.
Can you tell early on who's got what it takes to be successful and who doesn't? Are there sometimes surprises? I feel really far away from the people that have achieved success in their businesses in terms of clarity, productivity, and intelligence. Well, that's a good question.
Can you tell early on? I think you see signs. I think you see signs, but I actually think that's really rare. And that sign, them signs usually come from in regards to where they focus their time. Sounds like I'm fucking proper going on about time and priority management, but it's normally knowing where to focus their time. That's it. And you could go into kind of extremes of that, but yeah, there's certain things that you will probably see and go, yeah, they're probably going to do pretty well within the industry. But most of the time, probably not. Like, there is lots of surprises for me in years. Like, I've worked with thousands of coaches, like thousands of where.
So if you did hear that, I was repeating. I'll carry on this one so he logs on. He's just logged on, off, and coming back on again. So, yeah, I'll put my stake on it and hopefully he comes back on and he can finish up his answer. Yeah, I think there are signs. I definitely think there are signs. And I agree with Dan what he started with there in regards to where they prioritize their time. For me, it's the signs of someone being successful is having a growth mindset towards things. Hugely, I think that's such... yeah, I know, Rob. It's going to be pissed. That's a huge thing, is having a growth mindset of you can always get better at the things that you're doing currently. That's huge, because adopting that and I think practicing that as well is massive, because when you first start out, like, especially now where there's so many different ways of running a business and doing things and software and different services and price points and products and methods and processes, that's like, what, you know, it can get incredibly confusing, and obviously Now, with social media present, there is such a high percentage of new coaches that are crippled by comparison and imposter syndrome, because, you know, it's thrust into everyone's faces on social media every day. I think it's very, very hard sometimes to have that growth mindset. But for me, that's one of the indications, definitely. I think one of the other indications is, I think, the work ethic people have. Like, it's not an easy job. It's a hard job to do. It's a very, very hard job to do. Why? Because, first of all, working with individuals and people is very difficult, because you need to understand not just how to train people, it's human behavior. And that's constantly changing and moving with different people. And also, it's learning about business acumen, how to run a business. And that's something that we don't realize when we come into the industry. Secondly, we're not taught on our level three about it. And secondly, we have to literally learn this shit while we're doing the job, which is, again, incredibly hard. So, yeah, those are the things, I think, that more characteristics versus abilities, more will than skill, put it that way. And are there sometimes surprises? 100%, absolutely, absolutely, yeah. But in both ways as well, in both ways. Like, some are warning signals about way people think, but then some things happen where it's a breakthrough moment, and sometimes it happens where it's a breakdown moment. And I think those things are included. You're back.
Yeah, sorry about that. Don't know why it keeps doing that, isn't it?
I was just talking about answering that question in regards to, like, a skill versus will. Like, the skills can be taught, but having a growth mindset, a good work ethic. What is going on today?
Don't know.
Will far outweigh people having a lot of skills from the outset. And whatever you were saying about time.
Yeah, I didn't articulate it as much as well as that, but yeah, I agree. It was more so about where people know where to spend their time initially, I suppose. But yeah, doesn't matter now.
You can have the next one then. Best ways to use Reels to generate conversations?
Well, I think, first of all, you've got to grab people's attention to create the conversation. So then there needs to be a visual, verbal, or some level of hook that's going to drive people to look at it and then want to engage. I personally feel that most of the conversations that you will create will be more so in your stories off the back of the reel, in terms of asking questions. So for argument's sake, if your reel is to cover off a barrier that people have, then you can ask questions that will help people elaborate on that barrier or choose what barrier they have via polls or question boxes. What you'll also find is that if you put an open question, maybe in your reel, so if you're doing a short reel and you've got your hook, you put a bit of context into the caption, but maybe you put a question on the reel and got them to comment below, that will work. And then you can actually now, apparently, and I've not used this yet, so I don't know if this works, but you can also put polls on your reels now. So that will also help as well. But you're not getting away from the fact that people won't engage and get people to comment and all of that type of stuff if they're not, if you've not, that reel's not got attention or awareness on it. So grab their attention. So that comes from the hook, and then just be smart with your questions. But I believe that most of your conversations will start off the back of your stories more so than the reel. It's my opinion. I'm not saying it's 100% right, but you can clearly ask questions in your reel to get people to comment below. But I'd just be very specific with them questions. That's all I would say. Anything you'd add?
No, the only thing I'd add, which is something that I think people know, but also Simon kind of, it was a good little tip on actually, where you know that the viewing of people on Instagram is very, very short. I think it's between 7 and 15 seconds, and you can check that on your insights, what yours is mirror that with the hook, using the reel as a hook potentially, and put in the context in the caption below. But I agree with yourself, is that conversations, more stories, DM versus reels, but that will kind of set things up essentially. But no, apart from that, no.
Thoughts on podcast versus email for long content?
I think it comes down to preference on what you feel is better for you as an individual. I think, honestly, I'd use both. I'd absolutely use both. I think you can obviously elaborate on points on a podcast probably easier, and it's easier for people to consume on a podcast, purely because, you know, if we were going to write an email on one of the questions we've answered here, it would be a long email, but on here it's like maybe 2 to 3 minutes. So I would definitely use both. I would use both because you can put your personality across on a podcast, and people can get to know you on a podcast, I think, easier than it is from an email. But then I think you can give education and points on an email just as well. But on an email, you're obviously gathering your own database, which I think is massively important for any business to tap back into. So I think personality more on a podcast, and kind of future-proofing your business through email as, so there's a way I'd look at it, put it that way. And I think obviously as well, lead magnets nurturing through an email is again a great option to use, where you can then feed your podcast in. So they can be used together, but they're the way I personally would look at them, the differences between them. Any other way, anything you know? Have you ever sacked a client? And if so, how did you go about it?
Probably come as a surprise to most people, to be honest with how I am, but I've never sacked a client in my life. I've had conversations with my clients in regards to looking at their goals and what they feel like they need to be doing to reach them goals, and seeing if their current habits and behaviors are in line with them, which has then led the client to go, actually, no. And then led the client, me having a conversation with the client, and go, right, how motivated you feel to be doing them things right now? And they've gone, actually, life's got in the way, I'm distracted, it's probably not the best time, and they've just gone out that way. They probably was pissing me off and frustrating me, which has led me to that conversation, but I've tried not to get pissed off too much. And if I'm honest, in my early days of where I used to probably get pissed off more and was more direct than I am now, I was probably too scared to fucking lose a client at that point, when I was providing for a young family. So I didn't want to lose the money regardless at that point. So if I'm dead honest, the only other time that I can relate to this is that when we've had coaches in the academy and I've worked with them, and then they've maybe got to a point where they're solely focused on one specific thing, and it's deviating away from maybe quality and standards of coaching. And I've questioned that. And then therefore that's led to them kind of leaving, not on a sour note, because I don't think it's never anything personal, but them leaving and probably me directing them to somewhere else that is just going to solely focus on that one metric for them. So yeah, that's it really. I've never really had to sack a client apart from that. Have you?
Only one, but sacking is a bit of a extreme word for the process I went through. It was just a client that was constantly paying, and it was a time before I was moving to Australia, and they kept paying, kept turning up on like the first session of the week and of that month. And back then I used to do blocks, so that like first session of the block, and then basically just used to ghost me and not turn up and so forth and so forth. And that happened probably after the first month of training. They were fine in the first month of training. And it just got to the point where I was like, look, I'm not taking any more money. You're not turning up for the sessions. I think we probably need to stop there because I'm not willing to continue taking your money and not delivering anything. And it was kind of as black and white as that. It wasn't really a long conversation. It was more, I'm not willing to do this for, like, take your money and not deliver anything anymore. So it's definitely circumstantial, 100%. I think you got to think about what's getting you to the point where you're thinking about having those conversations and quote unquote sacking a client, and just question it, because it's always going to be a bit of a learning experience. Like I learned that then, you know, and that, to be honest, that type of show up rate in my early years was quite, I would say it was 50-50, like, because I was selling blocks and I was selling single sessions, and it was kind of that scenario. And that's kind of a big catalyst to how I developed the business. So yeah, I just ask yourself questions about what's making you think that, why, how, what was the process like, and definitely learn from it. But it's just an open, honest conversation, to be honest, with the client. Next.
I'm running a group program at the minute, a paid challenge. I'm finding myself just wanting to fully support everyone. Haha. Is there such a thing as, so mad, isn't it, to have to say that? Is there such a thing as giving too much when you're trying to over-deliver? Top question this.
I think if it's your first one, no, I don't. I think there's obviously, there's this conflict, isn't there? And no, I don't. I think deliver what you feel they need to get. The reason is because I'm assuming this is a group program which has got a time span on it. I think if you've got the time, if it's not approaching on your other business, and if you're reaching out to individuals in the earlier stages of this group program to give them a bit more support, over-deliver, like absolutely over-deliver, because what that will give you is a reference point to go, well, this was an integral part of that program that has delivered results for these people. Now, in the first instance, I didn't do it probably in the way I first originally planned, first of all, which is fine. But secondly, if this is an absolute non-negotiable that needs to be there going forward, then first of all, is it actually a group program going forward? If it is, perfect. Secondly, how can I systemize, automate, be more efficient with that feedback and communication to and from, if it is a defining feature of that service that is delivering the results for people? And I think those are the questions to probably ask yourself once you've gone through it. So, yeah, that's my take on it. Anything you'd add?
No, I wanted to agree at some of your points today, because it'd make a boring podcast if we just agree all the time. But actually, I found myself agreeing with that one again. I'm not very happy about it, but yeah.
If you're not getting inquiries, what is the first thing to look at / reconsider?
In order, the data, boring answer. Boring answer, but I would look at the data that drives the inquiries into the business. So if I was to reverse engineer this and go, right, for argument's sake, I'm currently selling online coaching. My marketing for that at the minute, my call to action is my inquiry form. And then off the back of that, my vehicle to get people to that inquiry form is my marketing on social media. I would look at my insights. I would therefore look at the reach things are getting, the things that is low in reach. I would look at why. Is there a good hook in there? Am I talking specifically to a demographic? Am I addressing a problem, a barrier, a pain point, a frustration, a fear? And is that consistent enough within the platforms I'm trying to get to? Am I creating multiple touch points? So people aren't just seeing me on Instagram. They're seeing me on Instagram story. They're seeing me on Instagram live. They're seeing me on Facebook. They're seeing me maybe on LinkedIn, depending on my market. They're hearing from me on email, and they're having multiple touch points with me. These are all of the questions that I would ask yourself. And what I would probably have is just a checklist. And you've got that if you're the guys in the academy on the new dashboard, but a checklist of things you can look at and go, no, I didn't do that. Or yes, I didn't do that. I did do that. No, this needs to be better. That needs to be better. So I would, yeah, I would look into the data and the facts and try not to go too much off your feelings. Normally it's a disconnecting, probably the messaging to your market, and maybe you're not asking for the business enough. So yeah, anything you'd add? Is that the last one?
That's it. Long one today.
Was a long sesh, that, wasn't it? Sweet. I'm going for a walk, Nick, to take me away from the screen. I'm going to go for a walk to take me away from this screen for 30 minutes. It's all right. See you in a bit.
Bye-bye.